This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the Amazon Store. Click on the link on our website, doctorwho.sqpn.com, before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show. Welcome to another episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
And welcome to another episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who, number 7 already. And today we are going to talk about the episode called Kill the Moon. Joining me are our regular co-hosts, Jimmy Akin, Dom Bettinelli, Father Corey, and Stephanie Zimmer. Is it Zimmer or is it Zimmer? I never know how to pronounce it. I kind of chose the German pronunciation, Stephanie.
Zimmer.
Zimmer. Okay, that actually sounds better. Zimmer. So, welcome.
Wait a minute. What was the alternative?
Zimmer, like with a D-Z. That's how you would pronounce the Z in German.
Okay.
It is a German name, but we say the American way.
Okay, I'm European, so forgive me if I mispronounce things from time to time. I'm Father Roderick. I'm from the Netherlands, and we have an international panel. Some of our panel members have woken up extra early to record to bring you this episode. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter because we're heading for the moon anyway, and I have no idea what time zone that is, but it's definitely none of our time zones. So as I said, we're going to talk about the episode Kill the Moon, and before we go over to our recap, and I hope you can help us with that, Jimmy, let me play the audio of the promo that we saw last week.
Hello, Earth. We have a terrible decision to make. An innocent life versus the future of all mankind.
Whatever future humanity might have depends upon the choice that is made right here, right now.
There we go, the much-anticipated alien-like promo, and, well, we'll talk about that in how much this was actually a bit of a kind of an alien thriller or something else altogether. But, Jimmy, what happened in this episode?
So, this episode starts out with Clara reaming out the doctor because he apparently told Courtney Woods that she isn't special. Courtney Woods, you may recall, is a young student at Coal Hill School that we met actually in the first episode of the series, but we didn't know her name then. She featured more prominently in the previous episode, The Caretaker, and the doctor even took her on a voyage in the TARDIS. But he apparently told her that she isn't special, and she's been devastated by that. And Clara is really angry at the doctor and is telling him to tell Courtney that she is special, but he's hesitant to do so. Instead, he asks her if she'd like to be the first woman on the moon, and is that special enough? So the three of them then head to the moon, but they materialize in a space shuttle that is crashing into the moon in the year 2049. The shuttle has a crew of three and a payload of 100 nuclear bombs aboard. They're on a suicide mission because 10 years ago, the moon had begun increasing its mass, causing the greatest natural disaster in history back on Earth through rising tides and things like that, apparently. Once they're on the moon, the gang goes to an abandoned Mexican moon base that is covered in cobwebs, and it turns out all of the Mexican astronauts are dead. They were there to search for minerals on the moon, but according to the doctor, they didn't find any, no minerals at all. Two of the space shuttle crew are killed by giant spiders. And one of the spiders almost kills Courtney, but she instead kills it with what looks like Windex. She apparently brought along a bottle of Windex from a drugstore or something, and it's supposed to kill 99% of all known germs. The doctor then announces that the spiders are actually giant germs, making them vulnerable to the Windex. He then learns that there are tons of the spiders underground, and he goes underground himself and returns to announce that the moon is a giant egg and that it's about to hatch, releasing the creature inside. The spiders are just germs crawling on the skin of the giant beast inside the moon. The remaining shuttle staffer, the captain, wants to detonate the bombs that they have and thus kill the creature, but Clara and Courtney don't want to. And when they appeal to the doctor, he refuses to have anything to do with the decision. In fact, he takes the TARDIS and leaves so that they can make the decision in his absence. He says, it's not my planet. It's not my decision. While he's gone, Clara makes a broadcast, apparently to the entire Earth, with 45 minutes until the moon hatches, and she tells people to turn out their lights if they want the creature to die, or turn their lights on if they want the creature to live. And apparently people in Europe and North America get a chance to do that. And guess what? They all universally turn off their lights. The astronaut lady is therefore about to push the final red button on a control box they have, but Clara quickly intervenes and pushes a green button to stop the bombs from going off. The doctor then reappears and takes the group to a beach where they watch the moon hatch harmlessly, and a kind of butterfly koi pond fish creature flies out. It also lays an identical moon egg in the place of the original moon. The doctor explains that this is the moment when mankind again turned to the stars after having turned inward on itself. Afterwards, Clara totally reams the doctor out for abandoning her in her time of need. And this time she is so angry that she tells him to go away and never come back again. And she storms out of the TARDIS. Afterwards, she and Danny talk, and Danny tells her that she's not entirely through with the doctor yet because she's still angry with him, and you're never through with anybody as long as you're still angry with them. And that's basically the spot at which the episode ends, on that kind of uncertain but ominous note.
Yeah, with the doctor going far, far away. Thank you so much, Jimmy, for the excellent recap. Stephanie, have you ever used Windex to kill spiders?
No, I have not. I know it's very helpful for other purposes.
What do you use to kill spiders? To clean windows, it's perfect, yes. I'm very much afraid of spiders, so I'm always looking for tips on how to get rid of them. Anyway,
this
Stephanie...
This must have been an episode you really enjoyed with all the spiders.
Oh, not at all. The promo already gave me the jitters. Stephanie, it's your weekly business as the host of TV Rewind to evaluate television episodes. So let me start with you. How would you evaluate this particular episode?
Well, when it first started, I would have given it a different rating than as the episode went on, as usually happens for different shows. So as they were walking on the moon, they had their spacesuits on, and we could see that the light to the creatures illuminates them and makes them scared. So I kind of had this feeling that it was kind of like the library and the silence of the forest kind of thing, where they had to be very careful about where they were going, and there's creatures in the dark. And so they had that kind of mode was going on there. But then as the episode went on, it seemed more and more like this was becoming a huge moral issue, much that I wouldn't have expected to see on Doctor Who. And and interestingly enough, turned out to be more of like a pro-life decision that they had to make, whether they kill the creature or they let it live, which is kind of interesting because it was also airing on the same weekend as that, at least in the U.S., that we celebrate Respect Life Sunday. So I thought that was kind of an interesting placement for the episode. Mm-hmm. Not that they knew that ahead of time. I'm sure the person who wrote it is probably not Catholic or have anything to do with religion, but it was interesting that they brought this moral decision into this talk, and I'm sure we'll discuss that a little bit more. But I really did enjoy the episode by the end. They made, obviously, the right decision, and the moon can go on to live and have another life. But I enjoyed it. I did.
Excellent. How would you rate it?
I would say probably an 8. It's pretty good.
Very good. Dom, in the past, you've had some criticism of certain episodes because they asked you to suspend your disbelief. How far did you suspend your disbelief this time, and how did it affect your appreciation of this episode?
Okay, I understand that Doctor Who plays fast and loose with believability. I really do. You know, next week we'll talk about it. You know, we'll hear the trailer. There's a train in space. I get that. Okay, I'm willing to go a long distance. I hated this episode.
That's what I thought.
I have a list here of all the ways that they just made a muddle and a mess of everything, and I can trot them out as we go through the episode. But you know, I just felt like, just on a plot level, I just felt like I didn't know where they were going. Was this about Monsters in the Dark? Was it about the moral dilemma? Was it about Courtney or Clara or the relationship with the doctor, or what was the point? I just I feel like they kind of had three different things going on that, and I never felt like I understood. And it just felt like it kept breaking with the established universe of Doctor Who, the things that we know. And so the one saving grace was that final bit with that where Clara got mad at the doctor, and that she had that moment with Danny, and then that final scene where she looks out her window at the moon. That was good. I felt like someone else actually wrote that, or maybe that was written first and everything else was written to kind of get them there. But so I would have rated the show lower, but I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10, based on that last bit. It got that high because I really did dislike this episode.
Wow, that's a very strict evaluation, Dom. But thanks nevertheless. Jimmy, what about you?
I didn't like it. I didn't dislike it quite as much as Dom, but there was a lot that I did dislike about it. I would, despite that, I would give it a 7 overall. I thought it was an okay episode. Some people were calling it an instant classic, and I didn't get that because of the believability issues. As I'm sure we'll talk about later, the science in this episode is all messed up. And I'm sorry, I know Doctor Who is science fantasy rather than science fiction, but it still was enough that it was a big distraction to me. And so it interfered with my ability to be able to appreciate the other elements of it. I did very much like the relational elements with Clara standing up to the doctor and so forth. But there was enough distraction there that I couldn't enjoy it fully. And some of the stuff that worked on an okay level, like some of the spider action horror stuff, I thought was just okay. I didn't think it was the best I'd ever seen that done. Alien did that a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Slightly bigger budget, probably.
Indeed. Although they have CGI now, which compensates a lot.
That's true, but they didn't use that much of it in this episode. But we'll get to that. Father Corey, did it bother you that apparently for an entire continent it is possible for people to turn off their lights in the exact same second?
It's supposedly over the course of an hour, but I was thinking about that, where as the lights are going off, you know, I know here in the United States, I don't know about places, other countries, most lights are automatic. There's no master switch to turn off the lights within a city. But yet you see entire cities going dark.
Yep.
You know, I did enjoy the episode. I'm not as critical as either Dom or Jimmy. I did enjoy it but I tend to look at it more as the creepy crawly type episodes, which Doctor Who in the past was well known for. I know it was a stereotype in England that in Great Britain that, you know, kids would hide behind the couch watching Doctor Who because it would spook them, you know, and this was kind of one of those episodes. And it definitely did that. I mean, it was definitely had kind of the spook factor with the spider bacteria things jumping out at you. I do agree with both of them that it did have some inconsistencies as far as science is concerned, as far as even just like the worldview, the whole world in general. It did try to kind of explain why, say, now in the 21st century, we're really kind of pulling back from manned space exploration. But then all of a sudden there was this point where they went back out into space. Humanity went back out in space. I think that scene where they're on the beach tried to explain that. So I did enjoy the episode. I might give it an 8, I think. But again, yeah, there were some issues with it. I wouldn't call it an instant classic like someone else had said.
I would definitely call this a classic episode, but more in the sense that it joins a number of episodes from the early days of Doctor Who where really, the consistency didn't really matter that much. It was all about how freaky the alien looked and how exotic the doctor's solution was to save the world. And we've been very much spoiled by some excellent writing in the past where they constructed like very complicated, big mythological story arcs that sometimes even spanned multiple seasons. And an episode like this is a bit harkening back to the olden days where it's really kind of like B material in terms of science fiction. However, it's executed visually in a very impressive way. I loved this episode from a visual point of view, from a the way they use the cameras. I love the sound design. It's something I've said before in this season. It's just excellent how they suggest things just by using sound, and they spend their money on a couple of shots that really matter instead of trying to, you know, what we see in other television shows like Once Upon a Time, where sometimes you get the idea that they have a very limited budget for CGI, and yet they try to do too much with it. Here, you can tell that they just use rubber spiders, and, you know, there's not that much in there, but they manage to create, to suggest a lot by just using sound. I appreciated that. But I also was very surprised by this episode, by the twist, that from what looked like an episode of one of the installments of the Alien franchise, it turned into this moral dilemma. And halfway through the episode, I was asking the same question that Dom had. It's like, what is their message with this? Where are they taking this? What are they trying to tell us? And I think that I found a few answers to that, but still, the at the end of the episode, I felt a little bit like, this was an episode on perhaps too many levels. They tried to do too much in one episode, and some stuff felt too rushed. There were a couple of things that were not well explained, especially the girl at the beginning of the episode, who is apparently in distress because the doctor had said something nasty to her. That felt a bit contrived and forced, and I wasn't even convinced by the way they wrote her role. I thought for a teenager, that is, it's too childish. I mean, I don't think that teenagers behave like that. So there were a few moments where I was like, meh, that could have been better. But overall, from the visual perspective, seeing what they did, you know, very, very impressive for a television series. So just on the basis of that, and for the fact that this episode apparently manages to completely divide our panel, I'd say that's a sign of a good episode. So I would give it definitely an 8 or even perhaps a 9 out of 10. Mm. But then again, I love space shuttles and I love the moon. So
I do too. Use them right.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the moon and how they filmed this. I just before we started to record this episode, I watched extra behind the scenes thing that they post on the BBC website, which is always fascinating because you get that B-roll footage of, you know, where they filmed this. And when I was watching the episode, at first I thought, it's a set. It's probably somewhere in a studio. And then I was like, this looks way too realistic. It looks so big. Actually, it looked better than some of the science fiction movies that I've recently seen in theaters.
Wait a minute, Father. Are you telling us they did a location shoot on the moon?
They went to the moon. They held their breath for 5 days of shooting.
That would be amazing.
I'm not kidding you. The budget for this series is going over the roof.
We really wanted to do it for the fans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, this entire episode, all the exterior scenes on the moon were filmed on the Canary Islands, on the island of Lanzarote, which is a volcanic area. And it actually really looks like that. The only thing that they did was to replace the bright sunny sky with pitch black sky. And I thought it was brilliant because that creates that harsh shadow that you know from the photos and the footage that we've seen from the moon landings. And they, of course, used a very clever trick to explain why they're not, you know, jumping like we know in low gravity, and it's just because the moon is getting heavier and puts on pounds. I thought that was a very smart way to be able to use a real location and then not having to worry about the way that people move on that planet. And they also, I think, did a great job with the costumes, you know, the space suits. We saw two types of spacesuits: the orange ones, which we've seen before in Doctor Who, and I think some brand new ones, which looked much more modern. And there is a great little minute here in this extra video behind the scenes about these spacesuits, and you just got to hear what Capaldi says about his spacesuit. So it starts with telling that they filmed everything in 40 degrees Celsius. I think that's more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Bloody hot. Wow. And then having to carry these big bulky spacesuits was a terrible ordeal for most of the actors. The newer ones even had, they cooled the actors down with tubes of cold water. It's unbelievable. But according to Capaldi, they actually, with the orange suits, were much more comfortable, and this is what he says about it.
I think it was easier for us. I mean, the other guys have got real big, major, new spacesuits. I'm wearing David Tennant's old spacesuit, so I only have to worry about hair gel in my helmet. I used to have hair gel like this.
And also, we get these special cool bags.
I'm only having to worry about hair gel. I don't remember David Tennant. I do remember the spacesuit, but did David Tennant's doctor ever go to the moon?
No, but he did use that spacesuit in The Waters of Mars, which was one of the specials. Yeah. And, of course, David Tennant did have that spiky up hair.
I just love that energy on the set. And then this extra episode just continues a little bit with a short montage of all the other locations that have been used in the past, foreign locations outside of the UK that they use. So I'll just press play again and we'll listen to that for a moment.
So you get to plug yourself in like an eco car.
Ooh!
This is the tubes with the cold water. And Capaldi doesn't like that either.
Like T-shirts with tubes sewn into them with cold water.
You didn't like that one?
I thought it was like being in a cold bath. I didn't like it. Reminded me of my frugal childhood.
This isn't the first time the Doctor has filmed for Doctor Who in over a decade, but many more instances quickly followed. Dubai doubled for the alien world of San Helios in Planet of the Dead, and a shoot in Croatia provided scenes for both the Vampires of Venice and Vincent and the Doctor. The team was back in the States for The Impossible Astronaut and The Day of the Moon, and this wasn't Mercy or even America. A town called Mercy was shot in Spain, with mini Hollywood and mini Texas standing in for the 19th century Wild West. And now the team has used Lanzarote as the moon. We've come a long way since 1967, when this studio doubled as our nearest satellite. But how long before Doctor Who is shooting on the moon itself?
Yeah, that's probably going to take a while before they are able to shoot on the moon. But it's a nice overview of how in the past they went to other countries as well.
It's funny, you know, speaking of on location in the old series, back in the classic Doctor Who, there was one particular rock quarry that I think they went to about 500 times.
Mm.
And they would just use different sections of this quarry to be different planets.
I think that is actually a quarry in Wales. And the reason that they didn't go there this time was because there's one thing you can be sure of if you want to film in a quarry in Wales, and that it's going to rain, which would be a problem if you want to suggest that this is on the moon. That's why they went to Lanzarote for this episode.
Yeah. But yeah, every planet,
everyone would recognize it, and it would immediately get unfavorable comparisons.
Yes.
Yeah. But every planet looked like that rock quarry. Every planet.
Yes.
Didn't matter which it was.
Low budget. It's like that factory that they've been using over and over again for the innards of a Dalek. And for I even think that, well, I'm not sure. The set that they used for the inside of the space shuttle, that looked familiar to me as well. But it might just be props that they've been reusing. Now, they've been to Lanzarote before,
right,
for Planet of Fire. I think. And they mentioned very briefly that there was a very old episode where they went to the moon for the first time, and they show a clip with the robot, the Cyberman, and it looked it's done in the studio, and it looks very, very old fashioned and outdated. But what was that episode about? Do you know anything about that, Jimmy?
Yeah, it's set in the year 2070, and it is a second Doctor story. So Patrick Troughton was playing the Doctor, and they end up on the moon and battle the Cybermen, and that's kind of the capsule synopsis of it. But it's only set, because this is in 2049, and the moon base is set in 2070, so it's only, 21 years after? After this story, and so they're apparently on the next giant moon egg in that story, though we didn't know it at the time.
They're on the new moon, which apparently has the same craters as the previous moon. Must be something genetic in the way these eggs are formed. Or is it just one of the many plot holes in this episode, Dom?
Don't get me started. No, actually, do get me started. I have plenty.
Yeah, you said you had a list. Let's before we dive into the themes of this episode, just rattle off your list. I want to hear all the, because apparently there are just as many holes in the plot of this episode as there are craters on the moon.
Okay, let's start at the top. Gravity on the shuttle in space. I know that the moon has somehow acquired extra weight. I'm not sure why that's supposed to be, but okay. But the shuttle is hurtling through space, going to land, and is gravity pulling them toward the floor? That doesn't make any sense.
They're not accelerating in that direction. They're going forward. They should be pulled backwards towards the back of the shuttle.
Exactly. Why did they think they needed the bombs if they didn't know there was a creature inside it to kill? What were the bombs for?
To blow up the moon, obviously, and create lots of the debris they're afraid of later in the show.
Yeah,
that's what I thought as well.
I didn't think 2049 was far enough in the future, frankly, to account for all this, especially since the Mexican miners had been there for 10 years. So that's only 25 years from now for the Mexicans to launch a private mining survey. But that's okay. That's not a huge plausibility problem.
You're just jealous because you're an American. You don't want the Mexicans to succeed.
Courtney gets to use her iPhone in a vacuum. I'd like to see that's a nice trick. Why did they have to send up?
It's the iPhone 8. It will be able to do that.
No, Courtney is from our time, so she can't. An iPhone 5.
Maybe the TARDIS has Wi-Fi we didn't know about.
Well, they have done the superphone thing before, but so I wouldn't fault them for that. But in terms of things Courtney is using in a vacuum, how about that Windex?
Yes.
Because they're carrying that around on the daylight side of the moon where temperatures reach 250 degrees Fahrenheit or 120 degrees Celsius, that bottle should have melted or exploded due to the absence of an atmosphere to hold it in.
Yep. more potholes. Why do they have to send up ancient astronauts? They had 10 years to get this mission together. They actually rebuilt the space shuttle from a static display that they'd put it on. Couldn't they have trained pilots? That was one of my... Oh, I like the terrible Mexican cliches. Like the serape, that covering that, you know, that sort of from every bad Mexican restaurant that happened to be laying across the chair and all these other things to make sure you knew these were Mexicans.
The cacti, which apparently were able to grow there for 10 years without anyone watering them. Now, I know that there are strong plants, but not that strong, I suppose.
It was also airless. The door was open.
Yep.
How does Henry hear the creature stirring underground since the moon is an airless void? It doesn't have an atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Why does Courtney float in that room, but nobody outside the room floated? That's a very localized gravity disturbance. Mm-hmm. So who laid the egg 100 million years ago? Presumably another giant space dragon.
Well, that's what Courtney asks. Is this a chicken? Because otherwise a chicken – and then the doctor is like, oh, cut it out. Too complicated.
Yeah, they were hanging a lantern on the problem there.
Yes. Right. So we know the moon is made of rock because astronauts have brought rocks back from the moon. I mean, this whole, like, the moon is really an egg. It's not an egg. We know.
And they found no minerals on the moon, not even in the crust that they were sitting on.
Right. And how did this newly hatched creature lay a giant new moon bigger than itself?
Yes. And where? How is this thing gaining mass? I mean, organisms gain mass by eating. So when has the moon been eating anything?
And why does it suddenly gain mass sometime in the last 10 years or something like that before, prior to this?
Yeah.
So, you know, just a few problems.
It's actually less plot holes than I thought.
Well, we haven't named them all. I mean, the whole thing about the spiders being germs, that's just crazy.
Yeah.
And they have cobwebs in a vacuum to catch what? Vacuum flies?
Astronauts, of course.
There's more. I just didn't want to monopolize the entire.
No. It's fun.
Amniotic fluid is not the stuff life comes from. It's the stuff that surrounds certain types of life while it's incubating.
Right. But I know. But that could be just the inside of the egg. So I guess that was just a poor man's version of what that fluid is all about in one sentence. I had a very simple question at the beginning. What's up with the shirt that the doctor is wearing? I've been intrigued by his black shirt with the tiny little white dots for a while, and now all of a sudden in this episode there are huge, like almost polka dots on it. Is he gonna end like a clown or what's up with that? Is there a meaning? It's too prominent to be a coincidence.
I did notice the shirt, but I just didn't make a whole lot of it. It's a doctor wardrobe change, so you know they do those periodically.
Yeah, but it's still funny that for two episodes he's been carrying this black shirt and it had these tiny white dots. It was so tiny that it almost seemed like they were spots of whatever he'd been messing around in the kitchen. And then now they're growing bigger. So, I don't know. It's perhaps just an inside joke, but I was wondering if there is any meaning to that or a reference to an older episode. But apparently not.
What bugged me at the beginning of the show was not the shirt, but the whole business about Courtney being special.
Yeah, what was that about?
Because, the idea that everybody has to be special is kind of like saying everyone has to be above average. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's true that we're all unique and special in that sense, but that's true of everybody. And the way Courtney was parsing it is, if I'm not special, then I'm nothing. And that's just ridiculous. And the whole thing just reeks of the kind of misguided self-esteem nonsense that you get in schools these days, where they inflate kids' ideas and give them a kind of sense of entitlement, to where you don't have to work to achieve anything. You're just automatically great.
That was what I was wondering as well. If this is kind of a reference to the hype around television shows like Idols or The Voice of whatever country the show airs in. And it's like everybody has to be famous. If you're not famous, you're not special. If you're not special, you're not acknowledged. If you're not acknowledged, you're nothing and you'd better kill yourself. You know, it's the kind of that all or nothing mentality that seems to be very much on vogue. What do you think, Stephanie? You watch a lot of TV. Is this something like a trend right now with all these popular television series that seem to cater to that need for especially younger people to feel validated?
I don't know that it's necessarily a trend. It's something that I've seen a lot. And unfortunately, it's that situation where every kid on the soccer team has to get a trophy or every kid has to get a certificate at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to be validated in some way. And unfortunately, it's I guess it's better than individualizing certain kids and leaving the others out. But there has to be some kind of balance between everybody wins or only a few win. I don't know what the balance would be.
Here in the U.S. a few years ago, there were a lot of bumper stickers that started appearing on people's cars that said things like, my kid is an honor student at such and such a school. Mm-hmm. And it kind of broadened out from – remember those? And it kind of broadened out from that to where it ended up being bumper stickers like, my child was recognized student of the month at such and such school.
Oh, my.
You know, I admit to be a bit of a curmudgeon on this, but my favorite line in response to this comes from the movie The Incredibles from Pixar.
Uh-huh.
And the mother, you know, the young boy gets in trouble for using his special power, which is to be able to dash. His name is Dash, and he can run really, really fast that you can't even see him. And so he gets in trouble for using that to prank people. And as part of the conversation, the mother says, "Everyone's special, Dash." And he mutters, which is another way of saying no one is.
Right? That's totally true.
Yeah, and they make the doctor seem like a really bad guy. Now, admittedly, telling a child you're nothing special is problematic. But in terms of his reluctance to go along with this whole specialness ideology, I'm kind of sympathetic to the doctor.
Me too. I thought it was refreshing. Yeah. And it's probably, I mean, you kind of deduct from this that there has been a conversation between Courtney and the doctor, because of course she's been taken into the TARDIS. She's seen whatever, you know, space. He opened a door for her and she was looking at the universe. And then apparently afterward, she thought that was, she was entitled to come along. And the doctor just brushed her off by saying, you know, I don't think you're anything special because, you know, I've showed you around, something like that. But it wasn't made explicit. So I kind of felt that was the actress who played Courtney. It was probably the lines or the way she was directed. But to me, it felt very fake. Felt just, come on, a teenager. Yeah, sure, it's a theme, but to behave like that, it was way too childish.
Kind of, it's kind of the stereotypical moody teenager is what it's supposed to be.
But it was way over the top. So anyway, the kind of the grumpiness of the doctor just felt much more realistic to me than the distress of Courtney. Let's talk about the yo-yo. The doctor uses the yo-yo once they're heading for the moon, which of course is the doctor is trying to solve the problem of you know, Courtney being depressed and then Clara being upset about that and being upset about the doctor by just choosing his own interest. And let's just go to the moon and have fun, you know, everybody happy. And then he uses the yo-yo to establish that there is a problem with the gravity. Now, I vaguely remember that we've seen yo-yos before in the Doctor Who universe.
Well, and we've specifically seen a yo-yo used as a gravity test. Tom Baker, the fourth Doctor, did that in The Ark in Space, which was one of his first episodes.
It's a funny thing. I wonder if this is going to be a standard prop of this Doctor. You know, like when the way the BBC portrays each doctor is almost in the same way or analog to the way the Catholic Church portrays saints. Every saint has an object that identifies the saint, because of course, you know, you've got monks, you've got ladies, and how are you going to tell the saints apart? Well, just give them, for instance, the instrument of their execution. So you see saints with a sword or with a seesaw or whatever, you know, a torch or all sorts of objects. And I'm thinking with the doctor, they're kind of doing the same thing with the very distinct clothes, and I was wondering if the yo-yo would become like the thing that sets this doctor apart. But have we seen him before in this season with a yo-yo, or was this the first time?
I think it showed up once where I think there was something where he had pulled it out of his pocket some point, or maybe like Robots of Sherwood, where all the stuff was pulled out of his pockets and the yo-yo was there, or something like that. I seem to recall Capaldi holding it at one point, but it was just kind of a flash scene, you know, where it's just he kind of pulled it out of his pocket and put back in type of deal. I don't, off the top of my head, I can't remember for sure, but just I seem to recall that.
He even uses it here as an instrument to sense what's down in a hole, and it has this fluid on it, and it's, oh, I know what that is.
Well, anyway. Did you know that yo-yos can affect the gravity too? Because he threw out the yo-yo at her, and all of a sudden she drops.
Yeah, what was that? I totally didn't get that whole sequence with her becoming weightless, and then the yo-yo apparently restores gravity.
It was supposed to be.
Apparently, gravity travels up the yo-yo string to the person holding the other end of the yo-yo.
Oh, that's it. Of course, I knew that there was a scientific explanation for this.
Well, that was the part of the muddled writing. I think he was supposed to be trying to reel her in, and then the gravity restored itself anyway, or something. Yeah. But it was just just so muddled. Like you don't know why the yo-yo was made its appearance at all, except it yo-yo.
That's cool.
By the way, Dom, speaking of the writing, you mentioned that it felt like some of the Clara, Danny Pink stuff at the end of the episode felt like it was written by someone different. And that's likely to be the case, because apparently this episode was originally written for Matt Smith for the 11th Doctor.
Oh, really?
But they held it over and thought it would work better with Peter Capaldi's more alien-ish Doctor. And therefore, it wouldn't – all that Clara stuff would not have fit the original story arc where she was the impossible girl heading to save the Doctor. And so my guess is that either they asked the writer to include that material, or more likely Stephen Moffat as showrunner just wrote that and did it on an uncredited basis.
Hmm. Fascinating. I did not know that. We learn a little bit about the Doctor in this episode when it comes to his – knowledge of the future, and since he's a time traveler, of course, he knows an awful lot about what's going to happen. But in this episode, he explains that there are certain moments that are undecided, and he does not know what is going to happen. He talks about them as little eye blinks, where you just, in the moment where you blink, you don't really see what's happening there. But again, I was wondering, how does that compute?
I was wondering, why do they need that? Because he's not omniscient, and they've never established him as having a sense of where things are headed. He's not precognitive.
No.
So I would assume anytime they need the Doctor to not know the answer to something, it's just something he never looked up.
Well, that was one of my problems here, is where it kind of breaks the canon, or breaks the established nature of the Doctor. Like, there's this one point after the creature hatches, I think, or some at some point like there, where he kind of, I think maybe on the beach, he kind of stops and concentrates as if he's seeing the future that now exists. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I'm not a great Doctor Who scholar, but I can't remember ever being established that he can actually see the future as it unfolds when things change.
Well, I'm not sure that he was trying to see the future there. It could also be I read it as if he was putting pieces of the puzzle together, and he was saying something really important, and it was more kind of like concentrating on this is an important thing that happens here. I don't know. It's
a Sherlock Holmes moment.
Yeah, something like that.
The way I kind of rationalize this whole thing is that this was planned by the Doctor from the beginning. He knew what moment he was going to take them to, because, you know, if we're going to have, you know, this the setup is Courtney special. Well, maybe the Doctor is going to prove that Clara is special by taking you to a moment in time where she makes a decision that affects the future of humanity. From one single decision, mm-hmm. and that this was this whole thing was planned by him for her to be the one that makes the decision that he knows the outcome of, and that he was lying essentially about not knowing what was going to happen, which is a problematic plot in itself, because we know that Clara is already special because of she's the impossible girl.
I know, but I was almost thinking that this was a test or something. The fact that there is a new moon so quickly, and it looks exactly like the previous one,
and is so much bigger than what came out of it.
Yes, but well, just regardless of that, it seems to suggest that the moment that the egg hatches and the creature appears and disappears, that is that eye blink that the Doctor just didn't see. He knew that there was a moon, but he explains to Clara, I'm not even sure if it's the same moon. Could be a different moon. Could be an hologram. Could be whatever, you know? So I've seen a moon in the future, but is it this moon? To me, it felt like that was the way in which the writer tries to explain away the fact that the Doctor really does not know about this, what happened in those few minutes between the decision to either kill the creature or not. But then I'm thinking, you know what, if they had blown up the moon, then that, I don't know, it just felt a little bit too much like a shortcut for in writing. We've got the question of the extra weight. It's 1.3 billion tons of extra weight that the moon apparently has gained. We don't know it, but I think the moon is eating ice cream while it's dark or something like during the daytime.
Like
and it's quite something. And then of course that would cause huge problems on the planet Earth. That's understandable. What I don't understand is why they even want to blow up the moon, because if the moon is not there, as if that does not create any problems for the gravity, right? I'm not a scientist, but what would happen if we didn't have the moon?
Actually, a number of things would happen, although some of them would happen longer term. You know, there'd be consequences for the atmosphere and things like that. There's actually a book, I have a copy of it, called What If the Moon Didn't Exist, that talks about how if Earth had not had a moon, how would the history of our planet have been affected? And it's quite interesting as a subject, but the weird thing is, not only would 100 atomic bombs not blow up the moon if you detonated them all at the same spot, but you just create lots of debris. I mean, this is something that even movies about asteroids hitting the Earth have already picked up on, that you just don't want to shatter the asteroid, or it's going to just make the problem worse and even more unstoppable. You want to gently nudge large objects out of the way. And so if the moon had been gaining mass, then the thing you'd want to do would be to get it into a farther orbit around the Earth to return things to normal.
I think they just – the doctor must have seen Bruce Willis pull it off and then think, you know. But well, that was an asteroid that was slightly smaller than the moon. But yeah, yeah, it was a crazy plan. But it seemed that they were out of options. They had to even get a space shuttle from a museum, and it was cut in half for so the kids could play inside. And somehow they managed to get it running again.
You know, there's actually – it just struck me – there's actually a bit of a parallel to that in American space history, because back in the 1970s, there was a – we had a space station called Skylab. And my father actually worked on the Skylab project. He was a mechanical engineering professor. And Skylab was actually made from a leftover Saturn V rocket that had been built for a potential moonshot. But they didn't end up – they ended up canceling the Apollo program. And so they recycled one of the rockets and turned it into Skylab.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. Wow. Fascinating. That's, I kind of like the idea that we saw a space shuttle again, because, of course, that's – the whole space shuttle program has been canceled. And it seems that outer space is something that we don't strive for to – you know, it's not something that you want to explore anymore personally by sending people up there.
The governments aren't, but, you know, we now have the burgeoning private space program.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's very exciting and is, you know, stands to potentially enrich the human race in significant ways.
So it's, in a way, this episode is very topical. You know, the question is, do we just stay here on our planet and look down to the ground, or do we dare to look up? Do we aspire, just like, you know, the whole race to the to get to the moon first was very, you know, invigorating and energizing for the world. But that's a fascinating question, and I like that they touched upon it here.
Yeah, and they do definitely hint on not everybody on Earth was focused inward, because, you know, there were the groups like the Mexican miners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they were going to explore the moon, that they were looking at places other than – yeah, commercially, not governmentally, but commercially.
Yeah, but it's not the same as that, you know, just explore for the sake of exploring. So it's kind of this inward attitude, which I think is definitely something that we're struggling with in at least in our Western world right now, is that we're becoming very myopic. It's all about the economy. It's all about our little petty problems. And we don't even want to look, even not even to other countries, you know. We're very much directed inwardly. And I think that whole, you know, the fact that we're canceling all these space exploration programs is almost a symptom of that attitude. But that is not, I think, the main topic, the main theme of this episode. Let's talk about this whole, you know, life, pro-life, who is going to choose, who is going to decide, the moral dilemma in this episode. Stephanie, you already talked about that in your evaluation of this episode. How do you feel they tackled this this big theme?
I think they did a pretty decent job. I don't know if they've done that many moral dilemmas like this in the past, and I think it might have been a very polarizing topic to include in an episode like this, which is why there's not been a lot of chatter about this episode. but I think they did a pretty decent job.
Did it surprise you that right from the get-go, Clara is talking about this creature as a baby? and it's like almost humanized.
It didn't surprise me because she is a teacher. She cares about kids and teaches kids. So I think that she was right in wanting to make the right decision.
That's a very good point. Go ahead, Jimmy.
She's also done this exact thing at least twice before, because in The Day of the Doctor, she's the one who is adamant against pushing the big red button and destroying Gallifrey.
True. Yes.
And then in Into the Dalek, she is the one who's slapping the Doctor in the face, telling him that he needs to save the Dalek. Mm-hmm. And so she's been very consistent on this. I thought it was interesting that in this episode also we get a red button to be pressed, but then right next to it this time there's a green button and she pushes that. So she apparently doesn't like big red buttons. Also, the whole moral dilemma thing, this is kind of a staple of science fiction, because anytime you encounter a new creature that is potentially dangerous, there's the question of, do we keep it alive and perhaps study it, or does it have a right to life, versus is it too dangerous and we have to kill it? And so you see that, for example, in the 1950s movie The Thing, where you have the military guys want to kill the James Arnaz giant carrot man, and you have the scientists wanting to study the giant carrot man. And then you see the same thing in Alien, where you have the corporation that everyone works for is wanting to keep the alien alive and study it, but you have the astronauts who are being killed off by it wanting to not keep it alive and study it. And so you see this recurring. It's just a question in any given episode of which side happens to be right.
That's right. Star Trek is littered with moral dilemmas like this, where very often the story is like this. There is this what appears to be a monster and it's threatening. But if you take your time and instead of immediately pushing the red button to gun it down, if you explore, you will often discover that it is a life form and so it has a certain right to live, and it's not as violent, or there is a certain logic to life. And a creature, even a monster, is never just destroying things for the sake of destroying.
In a lot of
science fiction stories, it's actually depicting monsters and aliens sometimes in a much more human way than we humans react. We are much more violent sometimes in our attitude and more, you know, black and white, and looking after our own interests instead of considering that something or someone who is alien to us might actually have its own value and dignity. But I still think the way that they wrote this episode, the language that is used, they're talking about babies. They're even Clara is like, oh, I want to have babies. And then the girl is like, yeah, Pink, Mr. Pink. So it was definitely written so that it makes us think about, you know, the whole pro-life and abortion issues and stuff. And I thought it was quite courageous for them to actually use that theme, which is, of course, a hot-button topic, which can also divide people tremendously. There was even a moment where the doctor talks about, you know, now it's up to you, womankind, you choose. Which kind of seemed to be like a wink to the whole, you know, pro-choice movement. Are they trying to give equal space or value to both sides of the issue? Or, how did they do a good job of that? What did you think, Dom?
There's an interesting aspect of this whole thing where it's the three women, and I don't know how much this is connected to this, but, you know, in neo-paganism, there's this, the triple goddess of the maiden or virgin, the mother, and the crone. And, you know, Courtney is the maiden. Claire clearly plays a mother role to Courtney. And while the astronaut isn't, she's not, you know, elderly, but she's definitely an older
astronaut, just like the other two guys.
And the triple goddess is represented by the symbol of the waxing, full, and waning moon.
Oh, and so, wow.
I'm wondering if there's some kind of connection in this moral dilemma and the baby imagery to
that is fascinating.
Wiccan faith, religion, and the Wiccan beliefs. So, I don't know enough about Wicca to be able to say. Uh-huh. I just knew enough to actually just find this bit out. So, yeah. I wonder if that's part of why this seems so muddled to me, and maybe it's clear to people who have an understanding of Wicca that I don't.
But you could also read it as it's three generations of women that have to make the choice whether to preserve life or not. And there is one of them who wants to kill the creature, and the other two, the younger generation, they want to preserve the life. And both Clara and Courtney seem to be very adamant about this.
One of the things that I liked about the astronaut's position on this is she's lived through what they haven't,
yeah,
with all the disasters that have been caused by the moon putting on weight. And I like it when she tells them, look, sometimes life is not nice. Not everything is nice.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a valuable perspective to have. And in particular, coming from a woman, because it's so easy to paint men monolithically as violent and women monolithically as life preservers. And having that mix within a single gender, I thought was realistic, and I thought it was nice to see that.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the other hand, if you're trying to read this for deep politics, and maybe finding a feminist statement here or something, what happens? They immediately turn to the rest of the world. They can't make the decision on their own.
Yes.
And so you have this crazy thing. Where they somehow broadcast to everyone on Earth who is apparently up at night listening to their radios or whatever.
Only half is up at night. The other half is up in the daytime.
Yeah, exactly. So half the world, okay, they can only see one face of the world. And fortunately for them, part of that is in darkness. But the people who are in the light phase of the planet don't even get a vote. And because they've only got 45 minutes, they're only going to watch the Earth rotate three quarters of a single time zone. So effectively, the only people who get to vote on this are those who are in Western Europe and North America. And I guess the Atlantic Ocean gets a huge vote, but there's no lights there, so it's on the side of death.
Yeah.
And then, as you already pointed out, you know, or as has already been pointed out, lots of lights are automatic, and there's no way to do all that. So I just thought that was overhyped, melodramatic, and unrealistic.
I think the whole voting process
poorly designed as a voting mechanism.
The voting mechanism was probably just as rigged as in any of those talent shows that we have on television. Well, you think you're voting, but actually it's all been pre-planned what the outcome should be.
Right, they ignore the vote anyway.
Yes, absolutely. But it was interesting to see that.
Well, Clara sabotages the election, if you want to put it that way.
Talk about overhyped. I mean, that whole scene of them going to that window, the explosions, the slow running, what was the point of that? This really dramatic transition from the room they were in to the other room. It was filled with, you know, the flames and explosions.
It's television, Dom. You got to make this moment count visually as well. So you just have to do that kind of stuff.
But then
notice the doctor shows up just at the right moment to rescue them. And if he had been serious in what he was saying about, I'm just going to take off for a while, there's no way he would have returned at that moment. They just all would have died.
Yeah. The big question remains, of course, how much did the doctor know? And this whole, let's talk about the conflicts between Clara and the doctor. Clara.
Do that, there's a great bit in the scene that sets that up right before the conflict occurs, where the
you're falling away,
Jim. Lady is can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you all right.
Hello?
Yeah, there was a little hiccup in the stream.
So the astronaut lady is talking to the doctor, and she uses the word bloody, which is a word that used to never be heard on Doctor Who, because in England it's considered offensive.
Yes.
And or at least impolite. And the doctor immediately goes up to her and says, "Watch your language. There are children present."
Mm-hmm.
Which is true since Courtney is there, but I think there's a kind of metatextual thing going on there, because There are children present in the audience, and so the use of the term bloody on Doctor Who has previously caused some consternation because there are children out there watching it on television. I thought there was a nice moment there.
Yeah, very, very smart writing there. And I think that he tells Clara as well to watch her language.
Uses the word bloody too.
Yeah. She's very violent in her reaction. I'll smack you so hard that you'll regenerate. I love that. You don't need battle eyebrows for that. But why is she so upset? Why? She has been with this doctor and she's been treated like this in the past. Why is there this breakup now? I don't get it.
I think, you know, it's going back to the whole conversation with Danny Pink where if he pushes you too far.
Uh-huh.
I think that she realized that was the moment that he pushed her too far.
And Danny alludes to that when he says he did it, didn't he? Meaning push her too far.
But in what way was she pushed too far? Just him stepping away and let her decide? Nobody wanted to take the decision. Everybody was like pointing to someone else. You make the decision. No, you make the – let's ask the world. It's this kind of not wanting to take responsibility, not to make your own choices. And it's almost as if the doctor wanted to force Clara to realize that she can make a difference, something like that, that her decision is not just arbitrary.
See, as I saw it, it was usually the doctor is the savior of the human race. Usually the doctor is the one who, you know, does what needs to be done so that the earth is saved. And the companions will assist with that. The companions sometimes will make the decision to do it.
Yeah.
But they're never the one that actually makes the action to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a case where that was dropped right in Clara's hand and the doctor disappeared.
Yeah.
And she had to be the savior of the human race.
Exactly, exactly.
But she had to do it not knowing what the better decision was. I know if I was suddenly asked to make a decision and I didn't know which outcome would be better and which would produce planetary disaster, I would feel resentful too if I didn't have the doctor helping me.
That's what life is all about, isn't it? And life is not always nice. You don't always have all the facts. You sometimes just have to make a decision. And the doctor wants to make it clear that this is not his planet. This is not his moon. This is not his decision. It is now up to what he calls womankind to take responsibility for the future of their own planet. And I think there's an important message there. And there is an Easter egg hidden in the final scene of this episode. I'm not sure if you noticed it. There's something written on the whiteboard in the classroom where Clara talks to Danny. Did anyone see what was written there?
Yeah, it was Dickens, wasn't it?
Yes. It was a quote from the first chapter of David Copperfield. And it is from the first chapter. And David Copperfield, of course, is writing his memoirs in a way, his life. And then the quote that is copied on the whiteboard says, literally, whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. I think that's the kind of the core message that Clara needs to understand, that the doctor wants Clara to understand. You have to be the hero of your own life. I am not the only savior here. I cannot always be there to make the hard decisions. You have to be the hero of your own life. And of course, Clara is kind of, I think, symbolizing all of us. You know, sometimes we have to make decisions. That's kind of what I gathered from that Easter egg.
I like the way she pushes back on him, though, where she says, look, you've walked under our skies. You've lived under our moon. This is all yours, too. He, even though he may be from another planet, he's bonded with the human race in a special way. And they've pointed that out in the past. And so for him to just walk away at a moment like this, I understand where Clara's coming from.
Well, he's also been, you know, he's taken on that role of savior of the human race. He's been there. He's been the one to rely on. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's deciding to walk away. You know, it's one thing to set a moral choice for someone, but to suddenly just up and, well, now it's your choice. Well, wait a minute. You're the expert. You're 2,000 years old. You have this body of experience and knowledge, you know, and this is a decision that will affect 7 billion people or however many we'll have in 2050. You know, this is a huge decision, and you're just walking away and saying, no, it's up to you.
And this isn't, you know.
I get that. But I still think that there is another side to this, or another aspect, and that for Clara, it's also something personal. She cannot live without the doctor. She cannot, and that's what Danny tries to tell her. You know, the fact that you're still angry means that he matters to you. So she cannot envision her life without the doctor, you know, being either that conscience or the decision maker or the savior or whatever. And it seems to me that what might be happening in this season or in this part of the season is that the doctor is trying to cut her loose. And he is distancing himself from her, wants to empower her, make her realize that she can actually live without him, because perhaps for him it's becoming too threatening. He doesn't feel comfortable with that role of being the savior. He doesn't even know if he's a good guy or a bad guy, right? So could this be the beginning of the final separation between the two? Are the writers currently slowly moving us towards perhaps a new companion?
I think they are. Companions typically stay around for a year or two. And so we already had Clara for half of last year, and then for the specials and for this year. And so I think they're consciously pointing towards the exit for her. And even Danny does that, because he says, you know, you're not done with him yet because you're still mad, but tell him this again when you're not mad.
Yeah. Which is, by the way, very Jesuit advice, I think. Never make big decisions in a time of turmoil. Wait for peace to reestablish itself.
Incidentally, this is not the first time we've had a companion storm out on the doctor like this. Now, and there's kind of an interesting parallel, because back in the fifth doctor's time, that was Peter Davison, he had a companion named Tegan, who was an Australian stewardess. And she had quite a number of adventures with the doctor, but then it just got to be too much for her. And there was a scene where she stormed out of the TARDIS, just like Clara did. She told the doctor, "This isn't fun anymore. I can't take this anymore, and I'm leaving." Mm-hmm. And so Clara's exit was reminiscent of that. And then what's also interesting is, despite the fact that Tegan walked out on the doctor, she was back in the next adventure. And so Clara's going to be back in the next adventure too. So it wasn't the initial permanent goodbye.
No. But it could be a hint that, you know, we shouldn't get too attached to the doctor or to his companions. Speaking of the next episode, Clara is definitely back. It's the next episode is called Mummy on the Orient Express. And it's not mummy in terms of mom, but although they could play with that as well. But it's an actual mummy. Looks exactly like the you know, CGI mummy from how many movies have been made about the mummy. Let's listen to the sound of that promo here. That is, of course, I need to turn up the volume of my browser. That would help tremendously. Here we go.
There were many trains to take the name Orient Express, but only one. In space.
Good morning, everyone. Your goal is to ascertain the foretold's true nature.
I know exactly what this sounds like.
Isn't this exciting?
It's immortal, unstoppable, unkillable.
Can we get a new expert?
Those that bear the foretold stare have 66 seconds to live.
Stop the clock.
Mummy on the Orient Express, and of course, Doctor Who will be back. We will be back as well next week to talk about that particular episode. To wrap things up, Dom, where can people find you or follow you on the interwebs?
They can find me on my website at betnet.com, BETTNET.com.
Stephanie, what about you?
You can find me on twitter.com/angelsteph, AngelSTEPH, or my podcast is at TVRewindPodcast.com.
And Father Corey?
You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Google+, all those things at Fr Corey Sticha, last name spelled STICHA. And I'm also on the Catholic Weekend podcast from SQPN.
And Jimmy?
People can find me at letswatchdoctorwho.com and at jimmyakin.com.
Excellent. And I can be found on Twitter as at Father Roderick, and you can just go to the show notes of this episode, which you can all find on doctorwho.sqpn.com. We'll include the relevant links there as well. And I'm also the host of a couple of other shows. We've just started a new season of Once Upon a Time, which is very similar to these shows. So if you watch that television show, you might want to check that out, as well as Secrets of Star Wars. I also do The Break and Geek Priest. For all those shows, you can go to the main website of the StarQuest Production Network over at sqpn.com. And if you have a moment, we would highly appreciate it if you could take some time to write us a review on iTunes or give us a rating with those shiny stars, which like to be together, all five of them. So if you have a moment, you can definitely help other people find this podcast as well. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. And we will be back next time. Hopefully, you too. Take care.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.
SQPN. Leading the way in Catholic new media.